more.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And good morning probably overstates the case by some margin, given how depressed and disillusioned I guess I'm feeling at this point. But that's another conversation, I suppose, for another time. My guest today is Peter Singer, the philosopher, professor emeritus of bioethics at Princeton University, and author of multiple books, including the landmark work Animal Liberation. His other books include Practical Ethics, The Life You Can Save, and Animal Liberation Now, a significantly updated edition of the 1975 volume. Singer has just published a hand-sized book geared for the holidays called Consider the Turkey. With Thanksgiving and other holidays just around the corner, this small but mighty volume delivers an impressive array of information, including the history of turkeys, how they're consumed in ever-burgeoning numbers in November and December, and the harrowing description of how, in factory farm settings, they're raised and slaughtered. Plus, in dire circumstances, the flock-wide illness, how they're exterminated. There's plenty more, ranging from vignettes with Cornelius, the charming turkey best known as the sidekick of Esther the Wonder Pig, to recipes from the meatless Thanksgiving that Singer and his friend have been celebrating together for many years. Singer is currently based in Singapore, so we recorded this interview in which we discussed a range of topics from the new book, Consider the Turkey, to U.S. politics and the election. I'll play back that interview with Peter Singer in just a moment or two here on Talking Animals. Right now, though, programming note, I'll be away next Wednesday, November 13th, and the fabulous Bab Capshaw will be hosting Talking Animals that day. And our guest will be naturalist Paul Jensen, who has a particular passion for Florida swamps. Also likely discuss the wildlife corridor, as well as specific ways to see and enjoy the wonders of Florida's wilderness. Be sure to tune in for that next Wednesday, November 13th, right here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Carrie Head, marketing honcho at Pet Pal Animal Shelter, who fill us in on the Veg Pelly Paul's dog walk run, the half-mile event being held Friday, November 15th, getting underway at Albert Whitted Park. All proceeds from the dog walk run will benefit Pet Pal Animal Shelter. More on this event when I speak with Carrie Head later in today's show on Talking Animals. Right now, though, let's hear my conversation with Peter Singer about, among other things, his new book, Consider the Turkey. So, recorded Monday evening and speaking from Singapore, this is Peter Singer on Talking Animals on WMNF. Let's welcome back to the show Peter Singer. Thanks for joining us again on the show, Peter.
Thank you, Duncan. It's my pleasure.
So, you're in Singapore as we hold this conversation, so on what may be the first sort of philosophical question raised today, maybe, I'm wondering, why Singapore?
Singapore has an excellent university, the National University of Singapore, which has a Center for Biomedical Ethics. As I've now retired from Princeton, and I'm living in Melbourne, it's a good connection for me to have. So I have a sort of short-term visiting position here. One of the advantages is that there's no significant time difference between Melbourne and Singapore. But another is that I think interesting things are happening in Asia in bioethics and in animal ethics as well. And so it's good to be here and be closer to some of those developments.
So are you researching or studying particular things that are taking place in that area?
I'm doing some speaking. I'm not specifically doing a lot of research, but I am finding out about what is happening to animals in East Asia. I've just completed a quite extensive tour of China. I was in China for 4 weeks, 9 different cities, did 24 speaking events. So I got a sense of what is going on in ethics, including ethics relating to animals in China. That was valuable. I'm trying to have some impact there. Obviously, it's a huge country and a very important country in terms of what happens to animals.
And so what have been some of the most notable things that have struck you in terms of bioethics in that area?
Well, I was interested to meet people who are doing bioethics and animal ethics in the what they call the analytical philosophy mode. That is essentially as we do it in the most of the English-speaking world, and are interested in that area. Students are very interested in it. Students seem to be participating in courses. Many of them have read my work and brought me copies of their books to sign. So that's interesting. But on the other hand, there's, you know, factory farming is growing enormously. China is by far the largest producer of pigs in the world, and they're pretty much entirely, virtually entirely factory farmed. Maybe a few running around some villages in rural areas, but, you know, that's insignificant compared to the quantities they're producing. Same with chickens and egg-laying hens. The numbers are enormous. And there is no federal legislation to control the conditions of farmed animals. Of course, that's also true in the United States. So you can't really point the finger at China for not having federal legislation about what you can do to animals on the farm.
Yeah.
But, it's definitely a problem in terms of the extreme confinement that they use there for these animals.
Is the factory farming industry in some ways only sort of growing and taking off there in China, or has it been this way for some time?
It has been this way for some time, but it's still growing as China has become more prosperous. It's got larger. They now have something that, to my knowledge, doesn't exist in the United States, and that's multi-story factory farms producing pigs. There's been reported that the one has 26 stories, just full of pigs on every floor. Wow. And, you know, the sows are in individual stalls where they can't turn around, can't really move. Again, that's true of quite a few sows in the United States, but the animal movement has reduced that to some extent by getting a lot of retailers, including McDonald's, to pledge to source from farms that don't keep their sows in those very narrow pens but allow them to move around a bit, even if they're still always inside. So, you know, and there aren't the comparable movements in China like the big animal welfare organizations in the United States, like the Humane League, Mercy for Animals, the Humane Society of the United States. Then there's nothing like that in China, and just some very small organizations. And of course, foreign nonprofits are not really allowed to operate in China. So it's a difficult situation in that respect.
And also there's just something kind of visually additionally disturbing about thinking of this being housed in like what sounds like sort of a skyscraper arrangement.
Yes. It's very disturbing. I don't know how much it matters to the pigs that they're on the, you know, 15th floor rather than on the ground floor, but it does suggest that the whole thing is so mechanized. In fact, they're using AI sometimes to monitor the animals as well without much human intervention. And it's all obviously geared to producing the commodities, the pork or bacon, as cheaply as possible. And the welfare of the animals isn't really considered beyond, you know, the fact that they have to grow and survive.
Well, at one point I thought I would ask you a little bit about being retired after 25 years at Princeton, how that was suiting you so far, even though it was probably early on. But of course, sounds like you kind of went from there into this new, at least partial position, almost immediately.
Yes, that's true, because July the 1st was my first day of retirement from Princeton. And by October, I was over here. And as I say, touring China and now I'm in Singapore and I'm doing a television program where we'll be talking about extending ethics to animals in Korea next week. So I'm pretty busy, but, you know, I never said I was retiring full stop. I said I was retiring from Princeton. I thought it was been 25 years. I thought it was time to try doing something different, and that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've got a number of things going. So it is different, although it sounds like it's you kind of step from retirement into virtually the next day or two into this new position that has multifaceted elements to it.
Yes, that's right. It's interesting to see the world from a different place and a different perspective.
Well, that's great. You're not slowing down, it sounds like, by a long shot, and it sounds like it's a pretty full schedule, actually.
Yeah, I hope I'll be continuing to work for animals and in general for a better world for all sentient beings for a few years yet.
And when you did retire from Princeton, was this Was this part of your plan, sort of, as like, yeah, I am going to, you kind of just noted the distinction between, yeah, I'm retiring from Princeton, but I am in no way retiring, period. And did you already kind of have the Singapore and Melbourne arrangement already in mind?
Yes, that was actually worked out. So I did know that I was going to do that. I also have been thinking about the possibility of going to China. In fact, I've been thinking about going to China for some years, but just not had time while I was at Princeton. But, you know, if we want to help animals and we want to stop factory farming or at least reduce factory farming, you can't ignore China. It's got four times the population of the United States. And although the per capita meat consumption is currently significantly lower than that in the United States, it's growing. So you could win the battle in the United States and even in Europe. And if you lose it in China, then there's still more animal suffering.
I understand. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Peter Singer, Professor Emeritus of Bioethics at Princeton University, author of the landmark book Animal Liberation, and has now written a hand-sized book geared for the holidays called Consider the Turkey. This interview was recorded Monday night. So you, as I've just noted, published the new book Consider the Turkey, sort of about the size of a hand. Fittingly enough, I guess it could probably be consumed over the course of a meal if you just sat down and just wanted to read it in one sitting. So we'll delve into the book in a moment, but maybe you could kind of just tell me how you conceived it and how it came together.
Right. Some years ago, I wrote a short essay with the same title, Consider the Turkey. Title is borrowed from an essay, Consider the Lobster, that was written by, David Foster Wallace, I think.
That sounds exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to write about turkeys because, of course, families gather around turkeys for Thanksgiving, and they don't know very much about how the turkey is produced. So most people who eat a turkey at Thanksgiving would not even think about the fact that this turkey has such a large breast that they cannot reproduce naturally. The male's enormous breast, which is been genetically selected to have more breasts because that's what turkey eaters, they all want a slice of the breast. It gets in the way and they can't mate, basically. So every one of those turkeys of this breed, the standard breed, which is called broad-breasted white, is produced by artificial insemination. And that's a very unpleasant procedure, particularly for the female who... normally, a turkey female is very selective in who she will allow to mate with her. She's really the one who makes the choice. But, of course, these turkeys are just grabbed, turned, flipped upside down, opened up, and the semen, which previously has been taken from a male by masturbating the male, the semen is squirted into them. And clearly, you know, they hate that. The workers who are doing it are doing it constantly. They're under great pressure to do as many as possible, so they will handle the females roughly because they just want to get it through, get it done, and if they don't, they won't be doing their job and the foreman will yell at them. So that's one aspect of it that I think people don't know. And then, of course, they are all factory farmed. Again, they're very crowded, they're stressed. You know, the young ones are just set loose since they don't have a mother around. They hatched from a hatchery. They're set loose in a shed. They're under all sorts of stress because they're constantly encountering strangers, and turkeys are social animals who live in a group and they get to know everyone in the group from birth, more or less. They have the mother's protection and guidance. These don't have that. So they're pretty much at a loss. A certain percentage of them will just die, although they're very young birds, but they can't take the strain and the stress. They're genetically bred to grow so fast and put on weight so quickly that their legs can barely hold their bodies, and that's another cause of problems. They have very common for them to have foot problems from bearing that weight, or leg problems, so that's another form of suffering. And then at the end, they're, of course, they're rounded up and pushed or shoved or sometimes actually thrown into cages on the trucks and taken to slaughter. And hung upside down on a conveyor belt with, again, their heavy weight stretching their legs before finally they're slaughtered. So it's a pretty brutal existence for all of these birds, and I think Americans ought to know about that before Thanksgiving.
For sure. Well, for decades, you've been thinking and writing about all kinds of issues that sort of intersect with Consider the Turkey. To what extent are you surprised that you didn't find yourself writing something like Consider the Turkey some years sooner?
It was always just a matter of priorities in terms of what I was doing. The previous project that I was working on that took a lot of my time was doing a complete update and revision of Animal Liberation. And that was published in 2023 under the title Animal Liberation Now, to show that really it is a new book. I'd say about half the material in it is new, was not in earlier editions of Animal Liberation. And I wanted to do that because I didn't want the book just to become a sort of historical curiosity. I wanted it to refer to conditions in the 21st century. How are animals being factory farmed in 2023? What kind of experiments are being performed in the 2020s, not just in the 1980s, as was mostly in the previous edition?
Yeah.
So that was an important project for me, and I'm glad I got that done. And pretty much after I got that done, given that I was still teaching at Princeton, I turned to writing Consider the Turkey. So it was a priority, something I'd been thinking of for a while, but it was always a matter of finding the time for it.
Right. It was just not that high on the list before the time came. So
yeah, that's right.
Under the heading of a taste test of sorts, I got to thinking that an interesting experiment would be to take your name off the book and have, say, 10 animal advocate types read it. My thought was that I think that people would find it smart, well-written, and illuminating, but might be surprised to later hear that Peter Singer wrote it. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I'm not sure. I hadn't thought of that. Why do you think they would be surprised to learn that I wrote it?
Well, to me, at least, again, it's valuable, and the picture, as you've noted, that it paints is super upsetting and information that people, by all means, should be exposed to. But I guess I felt like parts of it didn't reflect some of the kind of writing and sensibility that you have brought to other works. And it may just be that it was a shorter book that had a very tight, focused aim. But yeah, I guess I would be curious to flip my taste test around and see if people did read it, if they would guess, if they had a handful of choices, maybe that would be a more reasonable way to do it, to guess correctly that you were the author. I don't know. I just thought it was an interesting way to look at the book.
Yeah, it's certainly a much shorter book than I've written. But that was Princeton University Press's idea, really. They've had some success with these really short books priced at under $10. So it's, in a way, it's a long essay, and it has some recipes, alternative Thanksgiving recipes,
sure,
attached at the end of it. But, that's what they like. I think they've come up with an attractive design.
Yeah.
And I really hope people will buy it now before Thanksgiving, think about what they're going to be eating at Thanksgiving, or if they pick it up after Thanksgiving, of course, they can plan ahead for next year's Thanksgiving. I'd really like to change some of those Thanksgiving tables and get that large, dead, maltreated bird off the table. And there's plenty of great substitutes, as I suggest in the recipe section.
For sure. Well, the tradition and ritual that sort of typify Thanksgiving have, I think, a powerful pull. And you kind of describe in the book that you and your friends have long followed a similar Thanksgiving tradition, though obviously meat-free in this case. So when people read Consider the Turkey, they may well be struck by the information and the statistics and numbers and stuff that you cite. But if you had to speculate, what percentage of readers do you think will abandon their plans to eat or, in some cases, serve turkey at Thanksgiving?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Of course, those who actually read it are probably going to be more open to reconsidering what they're eating for Thanksgiving than just the general public. So, and I think it's a pretty powerful argument. But if 10% of the readers do change what they're going to eat for Thanksgiving, I would regard that as a satisfactory outcome. And if they then talk to other people about it or talk to their families, maybe more people, even if they haven't read the book, will change, or perhaps they'll pick up the book and then change. So I'd like it to be something that spreads and grows, ideally that becomes viral, that idea, so that we do have a change and we have a better informed public about not just turkeys, but factory farming in general.
Well, along those lines, do you believe an ultimatum is called for if friends or family want you to attend their Thanksgiving dinner? If you're trying to personally make that kind of change take hold, is that really what the best kind of way to proceed is?
I think so, yes. And again, I'm not sure if you can do that for this Thanksgiving, as the book's coming out like a month before Thanksgiving, and maybe the turkeys are already ordered, unfortunately, and people can't change. But I think you could put your family on notice. If you want me to join your Thanksgiving in future, I don't want there to be a large factory farmed bird dead in the middle of the table. Doesn't seem.
You have a year to kind of modify the menu.
Yeah, that's right. There's plenty of other things you can eat. So, and a lot of people actually say, well, you know, the trimmings are really better than the turkey itself. The turkey's a kind of fairly dry kind of meat. They don't like it. That's what they tell me. So, there are other things you can do.
And did you consider any kind of bigger role for Cornelius when you were writing the book, the turkey course that many of us became acquainted with as the charming kind of sidekick for Esther, the Wonder Pig? But I thought that was a nice appearance by Cornelius there, and I wondered if you thought at one point of having more Cornelius or more other turkeys that would somehow kind of help speak to the actual turkey existence and that.
I was very happy to include some information about Cornelius, because obviously Cornelius had a personality. Was intelligent. I liked the description of how when Esther had to go away for some medical treatment and stay away for some days, Cornelius was obviously missing Esther and went out to look for Esther on a daily basis. So, you know, that brings home the idea that turkeys are individuals. They have emotions, they have thoughts, they have attachments, even attachment to a pig, a different species. And of course, they would normally have attachments to the other turkeys in their group. So I thought it was really important to have that in there. But as I said, it was a short book. It was always intended to be a short book. And I did want to give the facts about, you know, how turkeys live and how turkeys die. So that's why I didn't have a lot more about Cornelius in there.
Right. You can only have so much Cornelius when you got a page count to track.
Exactly.
Sure. Again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Peter Singer, recently retired professor of bioethics at Princeton University, author of the landmark book Animal Liberation, updated, as he just noted, as well, and just published The Small But Mighty, Consider the Turkey. This interview was recorded Monday night. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, I'm speaking with you from Florida, which was recently battered by two pretty fierce hurricanes, one of which, Milton, also brought pretty horrible devastation to Asheville and other parts of North Carolina, areas not typically affected by hurricanes. So scientists and researchers, of course, attribute the unusual intensity and damage of these hurricanes and other extreme weather events that are happening really everywhere to climate change. So given factory farming's role in climate change, which is, of course, touched on and considered the turkey, what would you like to say about this element, the relationship between factory farming and climate change, and some of what we're seeing with these often super intense and often deadly weather events?
Yeah, I think there's clearly a relation, no question about that. As well as Florida, you probably read about the devastating floods in Spain. I think the death toll has risen over 200. That's a very extreme event. So, we are getting more extreme weather events. And although it's difficult to say of any specific one, can you attribute that to climate change? The scientists have been saying for decades, since the 1980s, in fact, that climate change is happening, that it will lead to more extreme weather events. So, when you put them all together, the number of extreme events around the world, there's no doubt that climate change has made those events more likely. And there's also no doubt that we're not doing enough to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We've made a start in some respects in that area, but that is all of the industrialized nations of the world in particular, because they're the ones that are producing the vast majority of the greenhouse gases, need to do more to slow climate change. I don't think we can stop climate change anymore. It's, as I say, it's already happening. It's probably going to continue to happen for a few years. Even if we were to stop greenhouse gas emissions entirely tomorrow, which of course is not going to happen. So it's a major crisis. It's an ethical crisis, I think, because one in which we are actually harming people in other nations. We're harming people in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, where the weather is already is hotter than it is in most parts of the United States. And it's going to get worse, and those people don't have the resources to defend themselves or even to feed themselves if there are these extreme weather events that people in the United States do. So it's clearly, you know, unethical of us to ignore that, also to ignore the future generations who can't vote yet but will be there and will be living in a planet that has much more extreme weather than we have even now. So it's a real ethical question, and we're failing. I would have to say we're failing that ethical test to consider the more vulnerable people in poorer countries and to consider the future. And we're selfishly going ahead with our very comfortable lifestyle based on high levels of energy emissions rather than putting every possible effort into stopping greenhouse gas emissions, which will include not burning fossil fuels, but of course will also include the meat we eat, because meat is a major contributor to climate change. Maybe 15% of greenhouse gases come from the meat industry, and that's something that we could really stop overnight. There's no need to eat meat. We could just stop that, reduce the number of livestock that are out there polluting the atmosphere. Just by eating plant-based foods. That's pretty simple and doesn't require any new technology in order to do it.
Yeah, factory farming's got a number of contributing factors that could be reined in, or if not ended, in fairly short order if the right moves were made, regulations, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's so many reasons to stop factory farming. You know, I originally was concerned about it because of its impact on animals and the suffering it inflicts on, you know, really tens of billions of animals, worldwide hundreds of billions of animals that we raise, vertebrate animals we raise in factory farms. So that's one reason. Climate change, just mentioned, is a second important reason. There's also the waste of food involved in factory farming, because these animals, we're confining them indoors. Obviously, we have to grow crops, harvest the crops, transport the crops to the animals. And then when they eat them, they use a large proportion of the food value just to keep their bodies warm, they're birds and mammals, to develop bones, which we don't eat. So we get back a small fraction of the food value we're putting into them. It's a huge waste of food. And if we weren't doing that, we would have agricultural land that we could allow to return to forest and soak up some greenhouse gases that way. So that's another reason to stop factory farming. And finally, it's now clear, many scientists have said, that factory farming is a virus breeding ground and therefore increases the risks of pandemics. We already had one pandemic, the one before COVID, that came out of pig farms. It was the swine flu pandemic. We're now getting the spread of highly pathogenic avian influenza, popularly known as bird flu. That has been shown to have spread to mammals and in some cases to humans, and apparently in at least one case from one human to another. So if this virus continues to mutate, we could have another pandemic, perhaps more deadly even than the COVID pandemic.
Well, and that reminds me, kind of even on a smaller scale, as you point out, and consider the turkey, another core of the factory farming world and the kind of waste too that you're alluding to. You really kind of detail when there's a flock-wide virus or illness and what the remedy for that is, which is if factory farming itself wasn't awful enough, that so-called solution is pretty upsetting.
Yeah, exactly. What you're referring to is known in the industry by the euphemism depopulation.
Yeah.
But really what it means is, you know, you get some birds with avian influenza in the shed. One of the standard methods used on millions of turkeys that I document, and even more millions of chickens, because, of course, there's more chickens produced than turkeys. You stop the ventilation in the shed, and you bring in heat. So you actually bring in heaters and you raise the temperature. I think the rules say it must be above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and it must be maintained at that level for more than an hour. And you also remove the water from the shed so the birds can't drink when in this extreme heat. And essentially you're killing the birds by inducing heat stroke into them. It can take up to 3 hours for all of the birds to die. In fact, sometimes they don't all die even after 3 hours, and people go through the shed and, manually one by one put the survivors out of their misery. But it's a completely horrific method of killing birds, and it's not permitted in other countries. It's not permitted anywhere in the European Union. It's not permitted in the United Kingdom. It's not permitted in Australia or Canada. So the United States is way out there in terms of how much pain and suffering it's prepared to cause to animals. Yeah. And that's basically just to save money. I mean, you know, you can do it much more humanely by, for example, pumping nitrogen gas into the shed. They will die quite quickly and without much struggle in a minute or two, rather than struggling against the heat for 2 or 3 hours before they die.
Oh, geez. Well, yeah, I mean, the factory farming scene and consider the turkey weren't enough to get you to reconsider your position. The depopulation, as you say, that's what a great semantical twist that is to call that depopulation. But anyway.
Right. And I'd like to mention, because perhaps some people who are listening to your program are veterinarians or have some connections and know veterinarians. This is something that the American Veterinary Medical Association actually does not condemn. It's refused to condemn it, I think, because of its links to big industry. There is a group of vets called Our Honor who believe that this is a disgrace and contrary to the honor of the veterinary profession and contrary to the veterinary oath. I go into details and have some quotes from some of the vets who do believe that this is a disgrace in Consider the Turkey. But I think they need support. And so if you know any veterinarians, please draw their attention to what's happening. Get them to contact Our Honor and perhaps support it and try to get the Veterinary Medical Association to really clearly condemn this practice.
Yeah, time to step up, it sounds like. Yeah.
Definitely.
Again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Peter Singer, the philosopher and author whose new book is Consider the Turkey. This interview was recorded Monday night. So we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, Peter, but since I'm speaking to you on the eve of Election Day, there's a few little things I just thought I would touch on with you maybe. One is kind of more in the slightly, I guess, philosophical realm. One of the storylines that's emerged in recent weeks is the large number of dyed-in-the-wool Republicans who've announced they're voting for Kamala Harris, exemplified by Liz Cheney, but there's many, many others. Now, these, of course, can be attributed to just a singular catalyst, Donald Trump. But sort of contemplating our conversation the last day or two, I was wondering about, for a guy who's been recognized as an influential thinker, what are some perspectives or positions of yours that have changed over time, maybe less dramatically than Republicans suddenly becoming pro-Harris, but just over time, what is a man noted as a philosopher, what kind of changes could you cite that maybe surprised you even?
Changes in my own position, yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that a couple of people pointed out in reading Animal Liberation Now, the new version of Animal Liberation, that I am a little less hard on people who continue to eat meat but try to source their meat from ethical sources. So the term they sometimes use is conscientious omnivore. I think that may go back to Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. And Michael Pollan is one of many who says he's not giving up meat entirely, but he is strongly opposed to factory farming and is not purchasing factory farm products. And he is, you know, eating more plant-based foods. And I suppose that's true. I have maybe softened a little because I really regard this industrial production of animals as the real horror, the thing that I would like to stop. And if there are some people who just say it's too hard for me to give up meat or animal products entirely to go vegetarian or vegan, I would say, well, you know, if you want to eat animal products, find a source where they really do have decent lives, where they're outside and able to range around. With eggs, that's not too difficult in the United States. You can get, I wouldn't just say cage-free eggs because those birds might still be very crowded in a shed, but, you know, look at the labels, contact the farms, check that the birds are actually able to go outside. And, you know, if you want to eat those eggs, well, at least I'm not saying there aren't any problems. The males of those laying breeds will still get killed as soon as they hatch. And the laying hens won't have a full long life, but still, for the life they have, that'll be reasonable. So, you know, that's a product that I guess I could be accepting of. And even the animals that are killed for their meat, again, if they have had good lives and they've been outside, it's part of really organic agriculture. That's just a lot better than the factory farming, both for the animals, for the aspects of not wasting food because the animals on the fields can get at least some of their own food. And, of course, they're not so crowded together, so viruses are less likely to spread through them. So, yeah, perhaps I've become a little bit more tolerant about that. That would be maybe the major change in my views over the last few years.
Yeah. Well, and I guess we should hasten to point out in that regard that as part of Consider the Turkey, although you're obviously urging people to not have turkey and not serve turkey and just steer clear of turkey, basically, that you do, as you kind of indicated here in this other realm, say, look, but if you can't or if you're not able to or circumstances prevent you from doing so, just try to make sure that the bird is humanely raised and humanely killed. So that's kind of an extension of that, right into the new book.
That's right. Yes, it is. And there are heritage breed turkeys who can mate naturally, don't have to be artificially inseminated because they haven't been bred to have these huge breasts of the standard American broad-breasted white. So that's possible. You expect to pay quite a lot more for your bird. But, you know, if you started off with this idea of an ultimatum saying I'm not coming to the family Thanksgiving, if you have a dead turkey on the table, but maybe if you want to compromise, keep the family together, well, for next year at least, probably too late for this year, order one of these heritage breeds in advance.
And lastly, kind of just following up on the election, eve of the election night thing, as I recall, if memory serves, you take a pretty dim view of how the U.S. handles elections as opposed to, say, how your native Australia carries out elections. Do I have that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
You have that absolutely right. Yes, there's lots of things about the United States elections that I think do not work well. One of them is this first-past-the-post system. You know, we have preference voting, so we still have single-member constituencies. It's not proportional representation, but you get to express a preference for, you know, you number all the squares of the candidates, and if nobody gets more than 50%, you cross off the one who gets the least, and then you look at who the people who are voting for that person and put a 2 opposite their name. So you've eliminated the one that they voted for, but you now go to their second preference and you distribute the votes according to that. And you keep doing that until somebody does get more than 50% of the votes. So on that system, Trump would never have even been the Republican candidate in 2016 because, you know, there were several candidates. And although he got more votes than any other candidate, the other candidates would have all put him last because they were opposed to him, as these Republicans are coming out now to say, you know, the never Trump. And I think that would have made a better decision. Then another thing is that our Australian elections are not run by partisan bodies, so they're not run by state governments who are politically aligned with one party or the other. They're run by independent electoral authorities, so we don't have these gerrymandered electorates that exist around the country. That's the second thing. And the third thing is we don't have any problems with turnout because we have compulsory voting. Maybe Americans are not really going to go for that, but I think it works well. You know, we have over 95% of the electorate voting every election. If you don't vote, you will get a small fine. It's not a big deal, but it's enough incentive to make sure that people vote and people see it as their public duty to vote. And that's reinforced by the fact that they know that everybody else is voting.
And also, Peter, isn't it like a Saturday or isn't there?
Oh, yes, that's another thing. Of course, that's right. Having an election on a Tuesday is a pretty strange idea.
Yeah,
we do have it on a Saturday.
There you go. So lastly, any opinions or predictions? I mean, when this airs, the election will have happened, but I don't know if we'll have all the presidential results in yet. So I don't know if there's anything you want to venture to either predict or opinion on how this is going to play out in the next couple.
Well, I will be very upset if Trump is elected. I see that as a possibility. I can't say more than the polls are saying, but I'm certainly hoping that that Harris will be elected. I think she's a good candidate. I applaud Joe Biden for standing down in the end. He could have done it a little earlier, but he did do it. And, you know, I do worry what these people who actually work for Trump are saying, right? Many of them are now saying, you know, he has fascist tendencies and that's a real threat. And you could say, well, they're all Trump enemies, but he appointed them to these positions in many cases. So, you know, at the very least, he's not very smart in his staff appointments because many of the people who he appointed now are saying, don't vote for him again.
Right. Yeah. To me, that's so telling, and was from his inner circle, as you know. So it's not just people that just have some crazy grievance. I mean, that they actually saw him up close and are desperately worried about him being returned to office. So that's got to tell you a lot, or it should at least.
Yes, it certainly should, and we will see what happens on election day.
Yeah. All right, Peter. Well, it's been great speaking with Peter Singer again. This new book is Consider the Turkey. And Peter's website is petersinger.info for all kinds of other information and writings and podcasts and other things you can find there. So, Peter, thank you so much for making the time to join us on Talk Animals. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thanks, Duncan. Yes, and you're right. I do have a podcast. That's another retirement project called Lives Well Lived. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you like. So I hope some people will tune in and enjoy that too.
So this is a far cry from retirement, as I think we established at the beginning of the conversation. Yeah.
It is.
All right. Well, enjoy your non-retirement, and thanks again for joining us on the show.
Thanks a lot.
My thanks again to Peter Singer. And again, the new book is Consider the Turkey. In a moment or two, I'll speak with Carrie Head, a Pet Pal Animal Shelter, about this upcoming event, the Veg Pally Paws Dog Walk Run, happening Friday, November 15th. Sounds like a hoot for dogs and humans alike. And the proceeds do benefit Pet Pal Animal Shelter. More on that in just a moment. I'm Talking Animals on WMN. Right now, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a short piece about a talking animal, fittingly enough. This is Amir Kay with My Dog Talk to Me in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMN.
Most dog owners have had that thought, like, I wish my dog could talk.
Yeah.
Right? You have that thought. But immediately after that thought, I have the thought of, he's too needy.
Yeah.
If Doogie could talk. And he had a cell phone? Dude, I'd leave the house for 5 minutes. I'd check my voicemail. It'd be like, you have 30 new voicemails. Boop! Hey, what's going on? It's me, Doogie. Listen, I know you said we're going for a walk. I just kind of wanted to touch base. And see what time you were thinking. Go ahead and give me a call back. I'm at home. Me again. Listen, have you seen my red ball? Yeah, you know the one we take to the park, Cassie can find it. Anyways, no big deal, call you can. Boop! The Amazon packages are here. tell you all, you're not going to want to go in the living room. Boop. I'm just kidding. It's me, Doogie. Don't be mad at you.
That was Amir Kay in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called My Dog Talked to Me About a Talking Animal, of course, taken from an appearance of his on Live at the Comedy Cellar. Now it's time to speak with Carrie Head, a pet pal animal shelter, about the Veg Pelipaws dog walk run coming up a week from Friday. Here's Carrie Head back on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. So I always think it's useful in these conversations to at least first just have a brief overview with the organization at hand. So if you want to just give us a quick elevator type pitch on the history, location, mission, whatever of Pet Pal Animal Shelter, that'd be great.
Sure. We have been around for almost 20 years now in St. Pete at our current location. We're a no-kill nonprofit animal shelter. Our mission is to pull at-risk animals from high-kill shelters, rehabilitate them, and adopt them out. So that is our main focus. We are located downtown St. Pete, in the Grand Central District.
Great.
Tropicana Field.
Okay. Well, that gives a pretty good sense of geography for sure. So, all right, so tell me about this Veg Pelipaws dog walk run. Let's start a bit with, can you tell me a little bit, actually, maybe we should start with Veg itself, the veterinary emergency group that I guess is one of the sponsors or the key sponsor?
Yes, it is the key sponsor for the dog walk. They are a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week veterinary emergency service. They have locations in Tampa and Clearwater, and they just opened a new one in St. Pete. So I believe it's that location primarily that's sponsoring us. They're providing volunteers and swag and the whole setup for not only the dog walk, but we'll have cuddle stations throughout the weekend in the mornings for the racers to pet some of our adoptable pups.
Now we're talking cuddle station. You had me at cuddle station, I guess I should have said, but that sounds very cool. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the walk run itself. So it's, first of all, it's Friday, November 15th, so a week from this coming Friday, and it gets underway, I believe, around 6 p.m.?
Yes, it'll be around 6 p.m. It starts at Albert Witted Park, and it's a little half-mile walk or run, whichever you prefer. It ends at the Runfest finish line on Bayshore Drive. So all the registration fees go to benefit the shelter, and for coming down and walking your dog, they're providing swag bags and the little bibs with numbers and a whole bunch of fun stuff.
That sounds really, really cool. And so you obviously can have your dog with you, but if for some reason the dog isn't like all that amenable to the dog walk run or whatever, you could also just do this on your own sans dog, correct?
Of course, yes.
And either way, whatever the registration fee still goes to Pet Pal Animal Shelter, which makes it great for everybody.
Yes, I think so.
So how do folks register or get more information? Is it the stpeterunfest.org website, or is there another thing more specifically to this event?
No, it is that one. You just have to scroll down. They have all the registration for all of their events. So you just scroll down to the dog walk and click on that.
That sounds simple enough. So again, it's stpeterunfest.org for the website overall. And how many participants do you guys anticipate for November 15th?
I believe they're looking at somewhere between 60 and 80 dogs right now.
Wow. That sounds like a massive turnout. And presumably a similar number of human beings at least.
at the very least, yes.
Yeah.
I would hope the same number of people for sure.
That's right. Well, it sounds like it's going to be very fun and a great way to help support the work that Pet Pal Animal Shelter does. So let's hope it's a big success. Sounds like with the numbers you're expecting, it sounds like it will be a big success. So that's great.
I sure hope so. It will be a lot of fun. And if you have problems finding it, you can find a link to it on our Facebook page in the events section.
Okay, fair enough. Well, Carrie, this all sounds great. I appreciate you taking the time to fill us in, and good luck on the event.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
You bet. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, we shift back to music. programming, with Jim Bannon holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., at which point our terrific Wednesday night block of Latin music kicks in. Meanwhile, on this show at the moment, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering something fabulous from the Talking Animals Vault to the first person who calls 813-239-9663, and call that number if you can... Name this animal tune. Sing an animal tune of Talking Animals on WNF. If you can name that animal tune, call 813-239-9663. You might even put your guess on the air. Otherwise, we'll take it after the show when it's Hi, you're on WNF. It's Name That Animal Tune. You're on the air live. Can you name that animal tune?
Barracuda.
Okay, we tried to make it fairly simple now and again. This was a good one, I think. So what's your name, sir?
David.
David? Okay, great. Well, you did name the animal tune successfully, and you'll get you some kind of prize. I'll come back after the show's over, and if you don't mind sitting on hold for a moment, and we'll get your information and send you off something cool.
Okay, cool.
All right, thanks for playing, and thanks for listening.
I'll be at the dog walk.
Right. Okay, that's great. Very cool.
Yes.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks, Ted. I'll be right back to get your information.
Okay.
Anyway, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Next Wednesday, I'll be away, as I mentioned at the top of the show, and the great Bev Capshaw will be hosting. Having a very good conversation, I think, with our guest naturalist, Paul Jensen, all about the Wildlife Corridor and all kinds of cool ways if you're interested in checking out Florida's natural wonders and getting tips of an expert to guide you on your wanderings. This will be a good conversation. So that's next Wednesday here, Talking Animals with Bev Capshaw. All right, so I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. If you go to talkinganimals.net, you can find all our past shows. Our archive there on Apple Podcasts as well and other podcast platforms as well. Also, links to our social media pages, etc. And you can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. So that's all at talkinganimals.net. Again, I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi, and beyond. Stay tuned for the conversation with Mario and Joe. And shifting back to music after that great show with Jim Bannon and Nancy C. So all kinds of great things on tap for you here in WNF Tampa. Catch you two Wednesdays from today with our great Ask the Trainer. We'll be back with Glenn Hatchell for that. So thanks again for listening. Take care.